What we did yesterday, we talked about the extreme poverty in the third world, third, fourth, and fifth world, as a matter of fact. The distinction between third, fourth, and fifth having to do with the level of income, that per capita income that they attain. John Schramm mentioned the other day that the definition of a fifth world country is a country where the per capita income is less than $70 a year, which includes Bangladesh and some of those other countries. So it's really extreme poverty when you compare that with the United States, where the per capita income is $7,000 per year. You know, compare 70 and 7,000, and you begin to comprehend some of the magnitudes of differences that we're talking about. But anyway, so we talked a little bit about these causes, and we suggested that population was sort of both a cause and a symptom of this extreme poverty, and that the other causes of poverty were related to unemployment, to low productivity, to the failure to accumulate capital, to the lack of infrastructure in those countries, and so on. And today, what I want to zero in on is more on the expectation and the reality of what can be expected in the third world. And so I want to start out by just talking a little bit about revolution, or at least get some definition of revolution in mind. So we're talking about the same thing here. Now, depending on your definition, a revolution is either of two things. It's either an event changing over a span of time. Okay, so you have an event changing over time. Some people define that as a revolution. Or two, and this is the definition I prefer, simultaneous events changing abruptly with respect to time. I refer to that as a revolution. And if we're talking about one event changing over a span of time, I tend to think that that's probably an evolutionary process. And so I prefer the first or the second definition as a revolution. Now, there are then some evolutions occurring in the world today which impact on the third world, third, fourth, and fifth world. And I think the first evolution that's occurring is this evolution of equality. We have a strive for equality in class, in sex, in race, in nationality. That's an evolution of equality. We have an evolution of freedom going on, self-determination for individuals, self-determination for nations. We have evolution of biological events, the declining birth rate or death rate, the increasing birth rate, the increasing population. I think those are all biological evolutions. There is an evolution of science and technology, especially as it relates to increased production in the world. And taken all together, I think all of those evolutions contribute to what I refer to, or what I, not what I refer to, or what I perceive to be what we mean when we say the revolution of a rising expectation. And you can just sort of begin to see this by looking around in the world. For instance, since 1950, there have been 1 billion people that have won their independence in the world. And just, I think just in the last 25, 30 years, 1 billion people that were not free before, that were dominated, have become free. In 1960, in 1 year alone, 25 African nations became independent. As a matter of fact, I can think of no country in the world today where at the very least, you know, alien rule is not being protested. Now, there are some countries where alien rule still exists. But in every country, there is a striving for independence, for self-determination, and no place do the people accept this alien domination. And even within the countries that have become independent, feudal lords, the princes, the sheikhs, the emperors are emerging and falling at a very alarming rate. And I think the rate of falling is greater than the rate of emerging. And I think also in this sort of revolutionary rising expectation, there is a striving on the part of people for some very simple things. You know, people would like an adequate and a nutritious diet. You know, they're simply not satisfied anymore with just a simple grain meal. People want things like milk, fruit, bread, and eggs. You know, and should that really be too much to ask for? You know, this is part of the revolution. If that's part of the revolution, you know, ought we deny that kind of stuff? There is an expectation regarding transportation, both mass transportation and private transportation. There's a revolution regarding education. In some countries, the striving for education results in battles and bribes for the few slots that are available for higher education. Intense competition, an entirely different structure, you see, than we are used to. There's a revolution, or within this expectation, simple things like consumer goods. Long lines in most of the world wait for things that we have plenty of, you know, not to mention things like cars, motor scooters, TVs, you know, radios. You know, those things are just virtually non-existent in those countries, yet the people expect. Yeah, so they expect these types of goods. Production lags tremendously behind the demand for these things, which causes then price to rise. And when price rises, profit rises. And you tend then to find a tremendous market for American investment, capital goods. American capital has always gone in search of profit. That's the hallmark of capitalism. And so you find a tremendous infusion of the direct foreign investment by Americans into these third world countries, fourth world countries. And that's in one way how Americans get involved in this. But the expectations then are for consumer goods. There are expectations for social services. You know, what was once considered to be a helping hand in times of need is now increasingly becoming expected as a private property right. You know, and that's tremendously important. tenant farmers are no longer satisfied to be tenant farmers. They expect to own the land. Now, that's what I mean by sort of this revolution of rising expectation brought about to some extent by the information explosion that we have in the world. Now, the serious part about this is that these expectations are rising at an increasing rate. The reality is that we can deliver those expectations at a much slower rate, so there develops an intolerable gap between what is expected and what the people have. And that becomes, well, in many respects, it should tug, I guess, at the sort of the heartstrings, if there are heartstrings, I don't know, are there heartstrings that should tug? It should somehow or other, at least if we're conscience oriented, it should bother those have countries of the world. It really should that do that. I'm not so sure that it does. I just mentioned a little example of Paul is here, and the other day Paul Wee was talking about Namibia, and I had just come back from a hike up to Heart Lake, and I had a blister on my foot, and I think I was really probably at that time more preoccupied with that doggone blister that I had. It hurt, you know, than I was with the fact that he said 228 of the 483 people that were involved in the march from Rhodesia to Botswana, you know, had been killed. You know, it seems like we're more concerned with the here and the immediate. But anyway, this is sort of this revolution of rising expectation. The difference between what can in reality be delivered and what the people are expecting. You know, a tremendous gap, and a gap that's widening because the expectation rate is increasing at an increasing rate, and the reality, that which can be delivered, is rising at a decreasing rate. So that as time progresses, this intolerable gap is getting larger and it spreads. You know, and some people see in this kind of a fermenting type of a possible explosive gap, you know. And all of a sudden it's going to go boom, and we're going to be involved in wars of redistribution, you know, that kind of a direction. I read some stuff by Gunnar Myrdal. I don't know how many of you know Gunnar Myrdal. He's a Nobel laureate, a Swedish economist who said, you know, that these expectations are rather loose and they border on meaninglessness unless they can be quantified. And it's literally impossible to quantify these expectations. But then I read other people who say, even though you can't quantify these expectations, there is an intensity about them. You know, there's a tremendous longing to fulfill or these shortages that are existing everywhere in the developing world. And even though we can't quantify them, the intolerable gap is going to lead to the dissension and to the unrest, and it tends to fuel the antagonism between the first and the second world and the third, fourth, and fifth world. Right now we're in a stage where there is some sort of competition, I think, between the first and the second world to make entree into the third, fourth, and fifth world. You know, but at least I'm of the opinion that in the long run, neither the first or the second world will really be able to deal with the problems of the third, fourth, and fifth world. And the antagonism, rather than one sort of between the East and the West, may become one of the struggle between the North and the South. Sure. Yeah.
Could you just define briefly first, second, third, fourth, fifth worlds?
Yeah.
So we're
By the first world, we referred to the United States, the Western Europe, the capitalistic countries of the world. By the second world, we referred to the communist countries, the socialist countries, the Eastern Bloc countries. By the third world, there used to be the first, second, and the third world. And so the third world then refers to all of the developing countries in the world, the Southeast Asian countries, the South countries, the African countries, and so on. Then at one time it was felt that the distinction between first, second, and third was not enough, you know, that there was as much difference between the top country in the third world and the bottom country in the third world as there was between the first, second, and the third world. And so we then developed grades of development. And so then the third world is slightly better off in terms of economic development than the fourth world, and the fourth world is slightly better off than the fifth world. I've seen some schemes where we talk about seventh world. I don't know I know what the fifth world is because John Schramm told me that yesterday. There's some specific definitional differences. The fifth world is a country whose income is $70 per year or less. But I don't know what the sixth and the seventh world is. Does anybody else?
No, one person has called the fifth world the basket cases.
Yeah. I know Bangladesh is a fifth world. Bangladesh may be the poorest country in the world today.
Well, I think fifth worlds have no no natural resources and are landlocked. I think that's
interesting. Okay, yeah, that's right. Yeah, they are landlocked and have virtually no natural resources. Bangladesh has lost, in the war in Bangladesh, they lost something like $1.2 billion worth of railroads, roads, communication, and so on. And it's going to take a country like Bangladesh virtually a decade or more to regain that which they lost in a war that lasted, 3 months? Extreme poverty. Well, I get the next thing, how are these expectations developed? You know, how does it come about that this third, fourth, fifth world have developed all of these expectations when for years we didn't really have to concern ourselves with the problem? It was sort of they didn't know and we didn't care. And since that kind of a gap existed, why, it wasn't much of a problem for us. How does it happen? Well, for one thing, all of the economic planning and all of the development process that has gone on in the third, fourth, and fifth world has brought about this expectation. For instance, if you were to read India's Planning Commission outline for the decade of the 70s, or if you were to read Pakistan's five-year plan, or if you were to read Nepal's five-year plan, they all have certain statements in common. They all have statements like, and I quote this from India's Planning Commission, that citizens, men and women equally, have the right to adequate means of livelihood. They talk about such things as equality in the distribution of income. They talk about such things as equality in the distribution of wealth. The literature on the planning commissions and the five-year plans are full of statements like social justice, democracy, adequate level of livelihood, equal opportunity, and this development and planning scheme has been spread by what we, I think, in the social sciences at least, sort of refer to as the information explosion. You can now go almost any place in the world and read Time and Newsweek. And so the information has just spread throughout the world as a result of better communication. Paul, we mentioned the other day that in Namibia, everybody has tape recorders, and they transmit messages using cassettes. So that there's virtually no place in the world where information on what's going on in other parts of the world is not readily available. So it's easy to see how these expectations have arisen. Now then, the question is, what are the results? Have we been able to deliver on these expectations? And I happen to read in India's plan for the decade of the 70s, between 1960 and 1970, per capita income grew by 10.8% or 11%. And you say, that's not too bad. Yeah, but what did it grow from? It grew from $95 to $105. That means that per capita income grew by around 80 cents per year, which almost becomes trivial. It's almost a joke. 80 cents a year per capita income increased by in the period between 1960 and 1970. Just absolutely sort of abominable. They're just... And what has to happen for these countries to develop and for these countries to grow? And remember now, I'm not making any value judgments about growth and whether or not it is growth that is really necessary or wanted in these countries. I'm sort of determining that based on sort of Western European capitalistic American standards, that we do want growth. We see growth as one way of eliminating poverty. So I'm going and I'm using that assumption. Now,
how can you go about growing? How can you eliminate poverty? It's one way you do it is to save. You have to save in order to invest. Accumulation can only take place if you take part of that which you have, and at least in economic jargon, in the terminology of Western capitalism, you put some of your consumption goods aside in capital goods. You don't eat everything you produce, you invest part of it. Okay? And in the future, that which you invest will, through increased productivity, bring you more. So you save today for the future. But how can you save when you never have enough to keep you from starving? You know, how can you save when your income is, $100 per year? You know, how can you save anything in a situation like this? And you see, into this kind of a scheme of suggesting saving to invest to have more in the future, you know, which is typical capitalism, and I'm not using capitalism in any derogatory sense here. It's typical Americanism. That's the way we're brought up to think. Okay, into that system then comes the American with sort of the individualistic dream, this democratic, free enterprise type of a system. It turns out that India is a democratic country. It turns out that Sri Lanka or Ceylon is a democratic country, and Nepal, they're all democratic countries. And the people of that country in the middle 1970s were being asked to vote in a democratic election to impose an austerity program to save for the future. On sort of the guise under the guise of the promise of democracy and freedom and capitalism, which would then cause the country to prosper. You know, but you know, how can you expect that to happen in a country like that? And in that same country, we are competing with Marxists. We're competing, you know, the Americans or the capitalists are competing with Marxists. And Marxism has the advantage of being able to promise and deliver immediate returns. You see, democracy and capitalism works very, very slowly. The price system determines which people go into which occupations. If there's demand for a certain occupation relative to supply, the wage will gradually rise. The increasing wage or the increasing price will call forth people to go into that occupation. Response to the higher wages. Well, that's an enormously slow process of allocating resources in a country where the income is $100 per year. And so we wonder why democracy and capitalism is being outstripped in Southeast Asian countries by Marxism, you know, by capitalism, or by socialism. Socialism is a much more direct system. It has the advantage of taking people and placing them exactly where they're needed. And then the Americans will counter, or the Western democracies will counter with such things as freedom. But at the margin of existence where these people live, you know, the existence is so harsh and so disciplined, predicated by their economic conditions, that liberty and freedom mean absolutely nothing. You know, if you lived in a mud hut, you know, and every day from sun up to sundown you had to go out and gather your food just to survive, would you really give? Would you really care about whether or not democracy and liberty existed? You know, would that even be what you're mainly sort of concerned with? So, collectivism or socialism, which sort of goes in there and promises immediate reforms, comes off sort of as a Robin Hood.
capitalism sort of almost looks like the Sheriff of Nottingham, you know, by comparison. And so slowly but surely, democracy is and capitalism is losing its foothold, if it ever had a foothold in that part of the world. We're losing our edge. Democracy and capitalism is lonely in the world. One of the things that will contribute to the extinction of capitalism is the fact that we are relatively alone in the world, I think. At most, 17-18% of the population live under capitalist types of systems. Well, okay. Yeah.
Just when you talk about freedom, of course, that's a big, slippery word. And I think you were talking about the freedom that comes along with capitalism. Western democracy is more or less individual.
Right.
Like freedom, mm-hmm. Individual, my freedom to drive my car, to carry a gun, or to even express myself, or to oppose the system. And even the Universal Declaration of Human Rights defines freedom in more or less individual terms. But I think there's a great reaction to that understanding today on the part of freedom people who understand freedom more as a collective, our freedom. How much freedom is there in New York City? Am I really free to walk? Because everybody's so individualistically free. The community is not that free, frankly. And it might have to be that in order to attain a greater degree of real freedom, we have to give up some of the individualistic type freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, these countries who understand freedom as freedom to eat, you know, freedom of the whole, freedom of the community, do not look at the newfound well-being under socialism as necessarily a lack of freedom. Even in a place like East Germany, where everybody has a color television set and good food, I think we mistakenly put it down because they don't have freedom in our sense of the term.
Or China.
Well, say China. That'd be even better.
Clearly, individualism is what we're referring to here. That's sort of the idealism that capitalism and Western type of democracy attempts to push. I have a hunch that even in this country, some of you may have heard me say this before, but I think one of the very dangerous cultural, can I get by with using that term, cultural contradiction in America today is the fact that we espouse this individualistic freedom. You know, that capitalism and democracy is sort of predicated on individualism. We sort of still cling to this, everybody can pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Only in America can everybody become president of General Motors. Only in America can you go from rags to riches. And then we have, you know, a society that's at least one-third collectivistic in terms of government intervention in the process. So I don't even think in our society it is really Hoyle or correct to talk strictly about individualistic freedom. But we do that.
I think it's important, too, to kind of note that that's an emphasis within our country today. It's not necessarily true of our history. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect, there was a corporate sense that was much more resonant in our thinking early on. And we've kind of evolved, if you will, towards that highly individualistic sense of it, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, as capitalism has become stronger, individualism has been... you know, sort of has developed. You know, I think.
I'm not sure if that's correct.
Yeah, because in the history, how they got to saying we, there sure were a lot of trade-offs and a lot of compromises before. before they got to the we statement. I mean, finally it was survival, giving up some individual things here and there, but strong individual viewpoints in that.
Oh yeah, but see, inherent in capitalism is individual freedom. You know, you want less collective action because it is easier, to some extent, to I don't want to use this to either to take advantage of people if they aren't collectively organized. You know, one individual against the corporation has no chance. You know, but a labor union against the corporation now becomes sort of two countervailing opposing forces of equal size. See? And so, as I think, you know, capitalism has continually tried to foster individualism. And during the heyday of laissez-faire capitalism in 1860, 1870, I think there was more individual freedom in this country than at any time. Since that time, I think capitalism has begun to decline, and since that time, I think individualism has also declined somewhat. It's kind of interesting to note that we, for instance, in the socialist democratic countries of the world, social security, national health systems, public or national pensions and that sort of stuff, developed probably between 50 and 70 years earlier than they did in the United States. Massive redistribution to aid the people happened between 1870 and about 1890 in most European countries. In the United States, it did not come about till it was absolutely necessary in the 1930s. And then there was a battle between then President Roosevelt and the existing individualists, you know, to even give in to this kind of a system. I think individualism is lock, stock, and barrel capitalism.
Jack?
Yes?
As an economist, what do you think of Jesus' statement, take no thought for the moral? You know, was he terribly naive? Didn't he understand what our capitalistic system would involve?
No.
Or if we really took no thought for the moral on an individual basis and were less greedy and less concerned about our own security, would there have been a more equal distribution of goods in the world? I mean, was he smarter than we think he was by saying that? I don't know many people that. Gandhi said life insurance is the highest form of atheism. What are we supposed to do with that?
Yeah, for one thing, I guess you almost have to even disagree with the older one. You're going to make this kind of a response, which I am going to disagree he just couldn't have been talking about a world in which the population is virtually 5 billion people, you know, because it's evident that you need a certain kind of economic order in order to produce enough goods to feed a population of that size. And so I'm not sure that you could feed that entire population by everybody sort of giving up what they owned and living just for today and not worrying at all about tomorrow. Now that's probably a very capitalistic type of a question. That's also why I don't think you can fit 6 billion people in the world into communes, you know, and have everybody live self-sufficiently. I don't think it's possible to be economically efficient enough to do that with this many people. Now, the second part of this, if we'd organized the world differently, perhaps the population wouldn't have reached the level that it does today, and then the system may have been working.
What do you mean by if we hadn't organized the world differently?
If we hadn't organized it along a line such as capitalism, for instance. I'm not so sure. Evelyn tells me that I make
I do a little injustice to population when I say that that population is the cause of poverty. Evelyn says, and I think, and you can correct me on this, that it's perhaps the fact that we are doing as well as we are is the fact that we have the kind of as large a population as we do. Is that right?
No, I think Paul Ehrlich and others like that are saying poverty breeds population and not population breeding poverty.
That's not a symmetrical statement with respect also to wealth and riches and so on.
No.
Oh, okay.
Is it possible that when, you know, Christ fed the thousands with the leftovers, is it possible that we too could do that, except that we don't, because we are spending the time sometimes rather than figuring out how to use today's product? We let it sit and spoil while we're planning for what we're going to do for tomorrow. I know how often you sit at a table finishing that meal, discussing what the next meal is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than enjoying that, and is it possible that because we have so much, I mean, Christ maybe thought we would have a lot more faith than we do. Perhaps that's why he said that. And we are scurrying, and it's fine to plan and all that, and that's what I work with too. But reality of it and thinking about it, if you think of his words and what we do, perhaps we are the misusers of what we've been given, even in thought or pattern.
Yeah, of course. See, what I'm torn between is sort of this whole question of what about future generations? You know, in other words, what does it mean for future generations if we don't worry about tomorrow? Do I have an obligation to the people that I know will be here 100 years from now?
Well, if you
is that as much today. Is that as much part of Christianity as Mary's statement?
But is it Christian to waste today only in preparation for tomorrow?
Or think of future generations, you mean like in care of the earth and not over planting? That's being good stewardships. I don't think being good stewards, you didn't necessarily have to say that was worrying about tomorrow. You're going to take the best care that you possibly can of what God gave you and use it wisely.
Yeah, still points to the future, though. You know, without, and then if you don't do that, why do you do that?
Because I would be commanded by God to be a good steward and to be faithful, I would fulfill that. Not that I was going to worry that if I didn't do that, God wasn't going to feed me next year. No? I mean, that's like.
But you're not advocating thoughtlessness for tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus is not saying be thoughtless. I don't think he would counsel us in that direction.
No.
I think the issue is maybe.
Well, what is the issue?
I don't know. I don't think he's counseling thoughtlessness.
The emphasis in that passage is on worry, isn't it?
Yeah. It's anxiety.
That anxiety for tomorrow, and that's the thing I think. We have to keep in mind there's no place where Jesus says, don't harvest the fields today because you won't need it. It'd be like a farmer would say, well, I'm not supposed to worry about tomorrow, so I won't go out and harvest the fields. I don't think that's what Jesus was advocating. He's simply advocating that we get rid of our fears, our worries, and anxieties. And the emphasis is here, put a little faith in God. Trust God a little bit for tomorrow. And I've always read it that way. I don't think that he wanted to tell us not to do anything for tomorrow. You know, don't make your bread today. You won't eat it till tomorrow anyway. You know, it'd be a rather sloppy philosophy, and I don't think that Jesus was an advocate of that kind of thing.
No, I'm just Evelyn.
It's interesting how that gets you the cultural conflicts in the Southwest where I live. You know, the good Protestants, I mean, save it all up, but against the manana culture, which we identify with Latin America, where you don't see quite that worry about it. And we sort of put down the manana as shiftlessness. And is maybe some of his lack of worry, is it real? I don't know.
Just to use it as a model, in the manana mentality, which I'm growing to,
right.
Practice.
Oh, he's in practice.
As he sinks in his chair and gives lessons.
Is there in that, I heard Sister Jose Habde from down in the Southwest, who was one of the most marvelous people who ever met, talk about the manana mentality and such persuasive ways. But I was wondering within that, is there some awareness of tomorrow? Are there healthy concerns that are future oriented in the manana mentality?
I wish I knew more.
Well, I think in the southern countries where there's a year-round production of food, and food is plenty and fresh, I don't can anymore since I live in California and there's just plenty of fresh vegetables. There's less necessity of putting up and especially storing food. And I know Linda, our daughter, spent 2 years in the Fiji Islands. And she said the Fiji Islanders would work just long enough so that they had enough so they could get along for a very short time, and then they'd stop working. And then when they ran out of money, they'd work a little more, but nobody ever could depend on them being there the next day if they had money in their pocket. They just quit. But it was part of the culture. The Indians who lived there, there were 50% Indians on the Fiji Islands, they were the industrialists. They were the ones who were really making the money and saving and putting away for tomorrow.
Yeah. And again, the hallmark, I guess, of capitalism is interdependence. You know, I am totally dependent on what everybody else does. If I had to eat teaching, you know, I would lose my midsection, I suppose, in about 2 weeks. You know, I got to depend on somebody else wanting education so I can barter that, in a sense, for money and so on. So we've developed a system where we are completely interdependent or dependent on others. And we've sort of introduced money to grease the skids in that kind of a system.
But we, you know, Jen, there's a problem with the whole development picture that I see, because I live in the third world.
Where?
In Colombia, in South America. It's great to talk about feeding the poor, and poverty is a real issue where I live too. The trouble is, and if it were possible to do that, and supposedly there is the technology and the land and all the necessary things to feed 5 billion people, the thing is that once a person gets a full belly, if you will, then they get the Coca-Cola syndrome. They're not happy with a full belly. Then they want a calculator.
Yeah.
And they want a color TV. Then they want shirts made in a certain way and so on. And what I see as there's an emerging very, very small middle class in Latin America, and the abject poverty maybe is just the very, very edge of it is falling away. When those people come out of poverty, what they want is not good, nutritious food. They want to go to Wimpy's, you know, really. And they want color TV, and they want to go to movies, and they want to fly on airplanes. And so where does development lead us? It's just like the people who came to these shores a long time ago and brought with them syphilis and refined sugars and all kinds of other things that were very damaging. As we feed the, if we were to do that and to be serious about it, what you do is you extend life expectancy, and you lower infant mortality, and then people's expectations rise even higher.
Yeah.
And you've got a bigger problem, because the guys with Chevrolets are going to start a revolution because they want Cadillacs. And that really does happen. It's happening all over the world.
Yeah.
So what are you saying? Don't feed them?
No, not don't feed them, but let's be aware that as we feed them, we're awakening insatiable desires. And the desire for food is basic, and once we get that, then we can desire all kinds of other things, and the revolutions will be over different kinds of issues that maybe we wouldn't sit here and say were such good issues. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying don't do it, but we're opening Pandora's box, and we're going to see all kinds of results of this kind of thing that we never expected before.
Yeah, I guess that's why I sort of have slowly gotten around to believing that. Well, some of you obviously know that I believe right now that economic forces influence social, religious, and cultural aspects more than social, religious, and cultural aspects influence economics. Yet I know that religion is important. Yet I know that familial and class structures are, you know, and so on, important. And someday, I really think that those forces will combine politically and become more important than economic forces. And then and only then will we see some kind of a change in the entire structure.
Is this not what's happening in Iran right now?
Well, I don't know.
To some degree.
I have some... That still is a... I guess we could, you know, just sort of enter into a discussion of religion here and what influence that would have on economic development. And then let me just preface your question by a statement, and then we can mention your statement. You know, I believe, and Paul and I were talking about Max Weber, and I read some of his stuff, not very much of his stuff, but some of his stuff. And I believe, as he said, that the Protestant Revolution was one of the antithesis, or one of the sort of the antithetical forces to feudalism. Okay? Because I really think that that the Reformation spurred economic growth, and that it led us into this notion of the work ethic. You know, it really freed us to make profits. It freed us to do our creative best, our work our hardest in order to accumulate. And I think all of that, you know, the justification for accumulation came about to some extent through the Protestant Reformation. Now, the question is, what about some of these other religions? You know, what do they believe, and how do they line themselves up with the forces of economic growth? And so you mentioned Islam. And my answer, I don't know very much about Islam. And some of you undoubtedly know more than I do, so you can add to this. But it seems to me that the Islam religion or faith, or whatever you want to call it, is infinitely pro-materialistic. So I'm not sure that do the rest of you have any, do you want to?
Well, the thing that seems evident to everybody's chagrin right now is that they've turned the oil spigot down to about half of what it was before, and that has caused us a great deal of woe in the oil-consuming world, and also shut their foreign exchange income down, I think, a good deal from what it was before the revolution. So somebody somewhere seems to have made a choice that it's more desirable to turn the oil out at a slower rate, even though it means a slowdown in all of the Shah's development schemes, than to proceed gung-ho with the development schemes and let the oil pay for it.
Can I interject some, you know, just a strict economic interpretation here?
Yeah.
You know, if I was in charge of distributing the oil in Iran, I would do exactly what the Khomeini did, mm-hmm. in order to increase economic development. Because I happen to think that oil, our demand for oil is what we call price inelastic. That means that you can cut down the supply, essentially, increase the price, and total revenue will remain at the same level. So once this whole upheaval is settled down, I believe what will happen is that Iran will probably sell us, you know, I don't know, 50% as much oil, or 75% as much oil, but the increase in price will more than compensate for the lack of quantity, and they will end up with more money in the long run. So I think it, you know, and that to me, even more than ever, emphasizes that the people over there really knew what they were doing. It's really kind of a very shrewd, monopolistic, capitalistic move on their part to do that. Now, I don't know if it's If that was the determination they used, but I would have done that if I were
the case of perhaps the religious desires of the mullahs and the economic ideas of some other people for once coinciding and making a certain course of action desirable to everybody's viewpoint. Yeah.
Now, I think Hindu religions, and I don't know how many are sort of up on Hindu religions, but I think those types of religions emphasize more abstinence, more monasticism, more withdrawal, more ascetism, you know, and those types of religions probably tend to be more counter-economic productive than something like Islam. And I, as a matter of fact, Southeast Asia India's primary religion is Hinduism. I know Nepal is and Sri Lanka tend to be very Buddhist. Is that right? And I think part of the reason why those countries have not developed economically is because of the religions that they do have, which are sort of probably more anti-economic and more anti-growth than they are pro-growth, you know. But they're by no means the only forces that have prevented economic development. There are all kinds of other forces. You know. Now, but that's, you know, that's not based on a whole lot of or a whole wealth of information. The reading that I've done in that is somewhat limited, so you can chip in here and challenge.
For example, the steel industry in India was primarily begun by Muslim people rather than Hindu people because of the aversion to getting mixed up with crass things like that.
Yeah. Yet I can remember Howard Wilson, who has done some writing. I don't know how many of you know Howard, but he's written a book on the emerging Eastern influence. And he refers to, and I probably even mispronounced this, but I think it's called the Panchatantra, you know, which is apparently a Hindu classic. And I had one of his papers along that I was reading for him, and I was reading in parts of the Panchatantra, and it says that wealth gives constant vigor, confidence, and power. Poverty is a curse worse than death, and the lack of money is the root of all evil. And that's apparently sort of a classic. The lack of money is the root of all evil. And that's a classic Hindu, a Hindu classic. I don't know what else it is.
It offers no solutions, and it's possibly a gross oversimplification, but I know we were in a discussion with one. Take something out of the Old Testament, like the year of Jubilee, when everything just returned, that you only earned for so long, and then you knew that you were going to give it up. And how that has almost happened, whether it be wars of redistribution across the whole thing, whether it be revolutions that have occurred, or whether it be our whole inheritance income tax structure. Some are saying that there is no accumulation, so that's basically a healthy thing that has occurred, even though we fight it at great levels, that there is a constant redistribution going on, and that this is occurring constantly. And to be sure, there were periods when you can accumulate and you can pass it on. In my parents' generation, it was, we will accumulate and give to you. And most of us have pretty well resigned ourselves to the fact that isn't the way it's going to be anymore. And I think it's sort of neat, sort of positive. They came out of the whole, not frontier mentality, but at least this business of, I didn't have, so I'm going to get, and you can have a part of it. And as I said, it offers no solutions to anything, but it's constantly happening on a worldwide basis. It's happening on a localized basis. There's something inherently healthy.
Yeah.
Of course, happening among the extremely wealthy in this country, or among the extremely wealthy in certain other countries?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you think that this leveling, this redistribution, is happening among the extremely wealthy in this country and in certain other countries, or is it more effective in middle class situations.
Paul, how do I know?
Well, I don't know. Talking to the subject, I was.
I don't know how. Although something that you said the other day would seem to suggest that it's not happening.
That it's not, that it's perhaps what you perceive as happening among the middle classes, but right. There's still a tendency for the richer or upper classes to accumulate wealth.
I remember. Escape income taxes.
Yeah. I remember, I go back to the Urban Training Center, I remember the simple conclusion, Urban Training Center was one of those things out of the early 60s where they threw people into the streets and that sort of thing. I remember coming back relatively confused from that whole experience because we dealt with the very, very rich and realized that they couldn't have any friends, couldn't have anyone. We dealt with the very, very poor and realized how they really were exploited. I fell in with a group of alkies, for instance, and man, they were paying $5 and $6 for drinks that we can go to the top of the most exclusive restaurant in Los Angeles and have for half the price. The poor, and the middle were mad at both sides because they were paying a freight for both sides, had no power either at either end. So I guess I'm reflecting confusion at that point.
You're in the condition that I'm very often in. That's why I was asking you.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, that's the wonderful thing about knowledge. You know, it breeds more confusion and more ignorance. Yeah.
If I could take it back to when we were discussing the Bible passage that Mary
read. I was hoping it wouldn't. Go ahead anyway.
It seems to me that what Christ was talking about there wasn't a specific, as in terms of don't worry about what you're going to eat tomorrow or what you're going to wear in your body. It wasn't just that much of a surface thing. I think what he was really talking about was that you don't worry about yourself. You'd be concerned for others and lose the consciousness of concern for self first. And I heard Buckminster Fuller this spring, and he's a very positivistic, humanistic man who says we can do it. Like someone over here said, we have the technology, etc., that we could feed the world. We could have everyone living in the freedom of health, about food, etc. But we're all saying, but why don't we? Blah, 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 blah. I think the Bible gives us the plain and simple answer. It is ego, it is self, and it is wanting to assert that. We call it sin, or that's the religious term for it. But if you want to think of it psychologically, it's just that most of the time, you are totally absorbed in yourself. And you're evaluating, perceiving the world from your own perspective. You don't jump in the other person's shoes. You don't feel the gnaw of hunger in their stomach. You feel the blister on your own foot. You don't feel the bullet wound. And I think what Christ is trying to teach us yet is to put yourself in the life of the other. And I think we need to get at the vision that Jay was talking about last night. We need to dare to seriously consider and live in the hope and expectation that Christ is going to convert our egocentricism into love for others. We have to be very open to that and to the death that has to occur in the process.
Yeah, I see at least 7 clergy types in here. We're going to have to respond to that. But
I was wondering along those same lines if he wasn't simply saying, if we are good stewards of what we have today with all that that implies, that we will not need to worry about tomorrow. And I think that implies an awful lot.
Stewardship is the original league. Who does it belong to?
Stewardship intelligence ownership.
I'm real interested in this manana theory that they were talking about and the people that they work with, because I work with in a poverty area too with children that are very young and come to school hungry every day. And being in that they live in this country, they are take advantage of a lot of programs that are given to them for food. And there's a conflict there within them and their parents and the teachers and the society and the whole surrounding community there, because they are given the food, but they don't they don't really eat it or care about it. It isn't a real important thing to them. You have to almost teach them to care about eating the food to nourish them well. You know, I'm talking about 5 and 6 year olds now. So much of the time they eat the whipped cream off the top of, you know, I'm putting that in the vernacular, the whipped cream, and leave the good stuff. And it's thrown into the trash cans. There's trash can after trash can of good food, good milk. I mean, I will go and take milk out there and stick it in my own little refrigerator and give it to someone later. Same with clothing. We have a fabulous clothing place there where we clothe the children. They're very reticent to take it. The parents are reticent to take it. I get very confused with the whole thing. We really want to give to the kids, and they need the nourishment. They have teeth that are rotting out. We can send them and make appointments for free dental, and they don't go. There's such an educating process that has to go on, and it is a very confusing. It really gives me a lot of confusion. If you could shed any light on to any of that, I think it goes along with what you were saying too about some of the people you're dealing with, because these are, most of these people are illegal aliens, and they they're hard. A lot of them are hard workers. But the free, you know, getting everything for free is kind of
like... I think my own experience working in a poverty area reflects what you just said and what you said also in Colombia. We remember having, one day we had big contests and prizes and all this sort of thing. And some of the prizes in that community were very essential things for the well-being of families. And then we had also some radios, television, and all this. And nobody wanted any of the essential things. They wanted the things that, knowing the reality of their life, made life appear to be good. Things that would allow them to escape from the harsh realities. And there was no real desire for the essential things. Now, if we put this in the context of your major thesis to begin with, when you talked about this gap of expectation over against the reality of fulfilling those expectations. You talked about this takes a change of heart. You talked about heartstrings and so forth. And this is what you're getting at. Too, I think that can apply to a group of people. I mean, that might appeal to a group of people. There are certain people that will be the major impulse for a change and for their bringing about change. And this is a rather unique group in the world. Maybe that's what the church is called to be, that group. But in fact, that's not the thing that's going to change that situation or Colombia or the situation in the world today. We're not going to, let's face it, go out and appeal to people's goodwill, whether it's to individuals or to General Motors or to anybody who has wealth, because no one will voluntarily give up the economic, political, or whatever power they have. So what is a more realistic thing? I think the place of this group that senses the realities and has a change of heart, as you call it, is important. But that in the final analysis, and maybe it takes these people to bring it about, and I think the freedom of the gospel allows it to happen, since Jesus underwrites no particular economic system of distribution or whatever. The Sabbath is always made for man, not the other way around. It takes control. It takes management, control. It takes, and maybe that's a question for Colombia. In a capitalistic system, of course, those expectations can leap all over the place. Mm-hmm. But whereas in a socialist type system, you have the rather hard and fast framework. At least you know that your expectations cannot exceed those of your neighbor, because you can only earn a certain level. There has to be a ceiling on earnings. You know that your profit cannot not be at the expense of your neighbor, at least not excessively. So that in order for equitable distribution to take place, and in order for the people in the ghetto area to receive what's better for their health rather than what they actually want, which might be the whipped cream. There has to be an imposed order. There has to be at least be a rigid framework that will allow the good of the whole to be taken care of, and the ego of individuals to be suppressed or to be put down. Now, is that the answer? This is what I want to ask in the Columbia situation. Now, what it is saying, in fact, that some form of socialism, if you want to use that term, or some form of imposed, equitable economic order is necessary to avoid these excesses that we've talked about here. Now, do you see that in the Colombia situation as being the answer?
No. In Latin America, that's been tried, not on a socialism basis, but in all of the other countries in Latin America, but two, Colombia and Venezuela, various kinds of governments have tried to impose one way or another. Mexico is perhaps the best example, where there have been two huge revolutions over land reform. And the rich, and I hate to say this, but maybe Jan can say something about this, the rich always manage to come through. I don't care how basic and how sweeping and how great the revolution is, it doesn't work. And I suppose, I don't know much about Soviet Russia, but perhaps we could even see something like that going on there. But it hasn't worked in Cuba even, which is maybe more utopian than other Latin American countries. And of course what the Pinochets and all of the other dictators do in Latin America is they impose those kinds of controls. But of course you know who's favored. It's not imposing controls so that there's equitable distribution of wealth by any means. It's imposing controls of another kind, and they're the only ones who have ever been able to do that, and they've done it from a military standpoint.
I'm talking about Allende, not about Pinochet.
Yeah, well, you see, Allende...
I'm talking about Allende-type controls.
Yeah, and Allende couldn't last because the rich always managed their way through, and of course, when they shut down everything, his government fell.
Disagree. It couldn't last because the CIA sabotaged the experiment.
Yeah, but the capitalists in Chile would have been able to do it with or without the CIA.
But doesn't that, it seem, you mentioned sweeping reform. Yeah. It just doesn't seem like the reform was sweeping enough.
Right.
Because I can mention two, you know, countries where it did work, Russia and China, you see. So there are examples. You can, I think, socialism, communism, has it within it to force change.
Well, you're saying that they are forcing expectations down in Russia. That's one of the things that's really causing a lot of unrest. They're having great economic demands for more consumer goods, and no matter how they try to impose it, it's a big problem because, you know, their economies, if we think ours is bad, theirs is,
Well, but see, they, to some extent, that's being allowed. You know, it's been sort of fed gradually as the country accumulated, get back to that, enough so that it grew and they were able to produce consumer goods of the time. You know, it was gradually being allowed that those could be gotten, and so the expectations rose in that way. But and China is now getting to the same point. You know, China is now reaching the stage where they think they may be able to start to satisfy some of those consumer types of goods. And so, but they're not sure they have the productive facilities to do it. It may be that I know Paul has some tendency towards socialist distribution system. Is that fair, or is that not fair to say? And to some extent, I do too. You know, but I still think that the production system in a capitalistic production system is better, because we have learned to deal with incentives and we can produce more. And I think that's probably what to some extent has happened in Russia. They have reached into our capitalistic production system, and I think that's what China is doing as well, you know. So in I see some
how did they taking the workers out on the Bam railroad, they just didn't go out there for a little stay. There's incentives, bonuses, and labor can't work.
Yeah. But what's wrong with then developing a system which takes the best of both,
yeah, right.
Which may exist, which may be the period that we're going into in what I call the intermediate, in the near distant future, whatever that means. You know, that's so ambiguous.
But the beast remains unchanged, just moderated.
And all yeah, but see,
well, all I'm hearing you say is that we impose control to take the edge off those insatiable appetites. We don't change the appetites.
Well, that's a step ahead.
Well, it's a step, but it's surely only a step. There are
some prerequisites too, I think, culturally. Like, I'm not sure about the Russian people. I know very little about them, but the Chinese people tend to be very disciplined people in their things. Latin Americans don't see discipline or organization as values. So it's much more difficult. That's why the communists, they had really poor luck in Latin America, and the communist movement, although it was very strong and numerous in Colombia, it was so diversified and so divided, and there's so much argument going on, and that they can't even get together to have a meeting. And so those kinds of things, you know, imposing any kind of controls, who would do it? Would it have to be an American or a Russian or something? Because a Latin America isn't going to impose controls, number one. Number two, the people aren't going to accept it, you know. So
if you think control should be imposed, more control, that is across the board in Colombia.
Whatever power authority exists.
Let's hear his response to that.
What kind of controls, Paul?
Controls that would equalize the distribution of wealth to a greater degree.
I really don't think so. I think it would just produce more chaos than is already there.
I don't think you can do that without purging. I don't think it can be done anywhere without purging. That's why you see the purges in Southeast Asia.
Because you see, they have things like, they have land ownership, they have private ownership of land and so on already, you know. And there is freedom of employment and things like that. Now, people are disadvantaged culturally and economically and because of their educational background and so on. I think that what came to me while you were talking before was that the church has the mandate to be the light in the world. And I'm thinking in terms of what Mary said when we first came here for orientation. She said lifestyle is very important in Holden Village. I think lifestyle is important for the Christian community. And for me, I have to speak personally as a missionary who, you know, sitting here in my $12 tennis shoes, to say to someone else that they need to share so that the poor can... I have no right to say that. I don't think any of us in this room have the right until our lifestyle reflects, right? And so that a small community, even in whatever place, could be that kind of light. I guess I would go that way and make example. You know,
the magnitude of the change that's required if we want a more equal distribution will surprise everybody. But it means that America will, in order to get complete and total redistribution, I don't want to say America. But the capitalistic and the communistic or socialistic have countries in the world will have to give up 80% of what they own, and that has to be distributed throughout the rest of the world. Which means then that for the average American, your income will be reduced from $7,000 a year, which is the per capita income, okay, to something in the neighborhood of $2,000. And now try to think of what you would cut out and what you would exist with if you only had 2,000. And the relative price structure would not change that much.
Yeah, wait a minute. I thought the new economic order in the UN called for a third American, first world countries, to cut down by a third.
Yeah, that's not for total redistribution. If you're total and equal redistribution, you cut 80% out.
Isn't this superficial? You're talking about 80% and a third. If you just look at it economically, reducing does not necessarily mean redistribution. You can slice the pie once, but it's got to be baked again. See, that's
the gospel.
You can cut the pie up and distribute it, but someone's got to bake another one. So that's
the next one.
Yeah, the what Mary was referring to is the third world countries are fighting for a new world order. New world order, if it doesn't come about willingly, the suggestion is that will come about forcibly through carteling. You know, you'll end up with an OPEC cartel, you'll end up with a bauxite cartel, you'll end up with, you know, what, a coffee cartel, whatever extractive raw materials that the Western world does not have, which exists in the sort of the third, fourth, fifth world, will then be carteled, and we will have forced kind of economic redistribution. The argument, the reason why it isn't getting very far, aside from the fact that I don't think you can get the have world to give up all of that, is the fact, is whatever somebody else suggested here, that very quickly what would happen, you know, if you redistributed this, very quickly the wealth would accrue back to its original possessors. You know, that's one of the arguments that's brought up as a sort of counter argument to that.
I often wonder if that wasn't what Jesus was saying when he said, "You'll always have the poor with you." We'll struggle against that, and I think we need to struggle against that. But I don't think we should live under the illusion that we can have equitable distribution in this world. But we should continue to struggle, just like we continue to struggle against sin, although we know we're not going to wipe it out.
Well, that's the thing. I like that, because I think we're called to be faithful and
right,
to do what we understand we have to do, if it's our lifestyle or whatever it is, and that we're not responsible for seeing that there is equal distribution in the world. I mean, I think that's a very different thing. I think that's the difference between grace and forgiveness and just feeling guilty about everything. The God of history takes care of what happens, but we're called to be faithful and not to make it come out right. And I think, for me, that's a big relief, and since I've realized that, I hope that's not a cop-out, but I think that's really how I can live and function and not just go around feeling so damn guilty.
Yeah.
I guess I'm too much of a Norwegian hoagie. I still would feel a little guilty. But that, you know, that's got to be the pietistic hoagie in me.
Guilt's good.
You can lay guilt on me. Yeah, that's right. I really think there is that in part of us.